Major Mills, Rail 4. Now, the next stage was to go to Ringway.
Yes, what happened next? On a Sunday, early October, we marched to Chesterfield Station, detrained in Manchester, and marched up from Manchester Station, I don't know, Codman, which station, right up to Ringway, arriving there on a Sunday afternoon, got ourselves bedded down and ready for work next morning. On the Monday, we began ground training, and we put a lot of enthusiasm into it. Now, this ground training went on for about 5 days, right until the Friday.
Now, what was it?
Now, the ground training was endless falling and somersaulting, learning to fall obliquely, learning to keep your legs together. We were on the fan, and the fan is simply a windlass in the ceiling around which a wire is attached and has a fan at the end of it. There's a shoulder harness on the end of the wire. You put the shoulder harness on yourself, you jump off from this platform, which is the ceiling of a hangar, and immediately the wire stretches, the fan on the spindle slows it down, and it drops you on the ground at parachuting speed. And that's an exercise which is thoroughly enjoyed. It gives you confidence in your ability to fall. And so we were on the fan day after day. Another one which was a little bit iffy, we were hung in a parachute harness and swung from the ceiling. And you just swung like a child in a swing until your instructor pressed a bomb release which released you and the harness and tippled you towards the ground. Now, you had to be very alert for that one because you could get hurt if you mistimed it. We were taught the drill in dummy aircraft or making our way to the hole, casting ourselves off through the hole because you had to swing your legs over and push yourself out and immediately take an attitude absolutely rigid in the air as you went through with your hands to your sides and let the parachute do its work. And this went on until Friday evening. When they took us out to, in the early part of the evening, they took us out to Tatton Park to do our first balloon drop. Now this was rather lucky for me because I was due to head the third stick. And you know how it is, when things come suddenly to you, you don't get time to get apprehensive. So the first stick of, I think we're going up in sticks of 8 in these balloons, first stick came out, and the second stick started loading, and the instructor of that stick shouted across to my sergeant instructor, he said, "Eric, I got room for one more." So it was me. So I went up with this second stick, so it came to me before it was due to come to me. I was the last person out. But there was I alone in the balloon with the staff sergeant instructor, and he gave me a good order to go, and I went out, and I was so relieved to see the chute develop over my head. And
Have you been nervous?
You're not nervous. You've just determined. It's a determination that you're not going to be nervous because in front of the troops and everything else, all the train that's being packed, put into you, how can you turn back? You've just got to go. I've often said paratroops are not allowed to be afraid.
Now, how did you actually jump? This was through a hole in the bottom
through a hole in the gondola of the balloon. Yep.
And it was a static line. It's
a static balloon, and a static line drop, yes, it's all static line stuff. And the thing I do remember so well was that you don't lose the sense of being suspended all the way through the whole of the jump, even the aircraft. You feel that something is holding you up all the time. And anyway, my landing was uneventful.
What was it like coming down? It was your first jump. I mean, some people really enjoy it.
Lovely feeling of floating to Earth. And then the Earth starts coming towards you rather quicker than you expect. And then you pull yourself together, remember your landing drill and exercise as best you can. And then
What was the landing drill? Just fill in.
Well, you should be coming in forward, and then as you come in, you keep your heels and legs together, hunch your shoulders slightly, keep your elbows in, and allow yourself to fall obliquely onto your side. That is an ideal landing drill, and of course the real clever chaps are very good at doing stand-up landings and all that sort of thing, but that's how we were taught to land.
So, how did you feel after your first, when you got there?
It's a feeling, everybody had a feeling of euphoria. The whole lot, just complete euphoria. So the next day, for the Saturday morning was our next jump, and there was a hell of a wind blowing. So, anyway, it didn't matter. Up we went, down we came. When we came back for debriefing, the officer, the squadron leader, Murphy, he said, "I want to congratulate all of you for doing your second jump in that appalling weather this morning." He said, "I take my hat off to you," and all that sort of thing. He said, "Take the rest of the day off." So we all went off.
What difference did the wind make to you?
Well, it's so bloody whistling and howling when you get up to 800 feet. You really feel it. But once you're out of the balloon, you don't worry about the wind.
Didn't it blow you? You
know. Not noticeably. I don't remember. It was just the unpleasantness of sitting in this balloon with this howling gale up there. So we had the Saturday off. I don't think we jumped on the Sunday. The next week...
Hang on. Can I just ask, had you had the sort of parachute familiarisation training where you sort of look at how a parachute's packed and see, you know...
Oh, we'd been shown... we'd been taken through the packing sheds.
Tell me about that.
Well, two things. We were taken through the packing sheds and explained how the girls do not flirt with us because they're not allowed to. They've got to keep their minds on their job. And there's notices there saying, remember, a man's life depends on you. And then there was a very nice chap. He was a warrant officer who had an Air Force cross. He gave us a demonstration on the ground of how a parachute operates. You know, he was cutting the tapes, cutting the string with a pair of scissors and all that sort of thing. A very good lecture indeed. So we had all that sort of thing before we went in. And the other thing, before we took off, you walk up to a hatch and a parachute comes out to you, and an NCO immediately records the parachute number and the static line number. They're two separate numbers, and he records them from the equipment you've just picked up. And then you get into it, and we're shown, of course, how to put it on, how to make ourselves really comfortable.
How do you?
Well, what you want to do is to make certain that the seat part is really a seat part. You want to feel it around your groins and all that sort of thing, and the chute itself fairly high on your back. It's a trial and error, and you get it right. And leg straps straight through back into the box, and the box should be sort of middle of your front of your torso. And of course we also got dragging drill too. I'd forgotten about that. Another thing.
What's dragging?
Well, you see, the wind can drag you, and you've got to get out of that chute. When you've hit the ground, the wind will drag you. You've got to get out of that chute. Now, the way to do it is to turn over on your back, thump your box to release all four straps.
This is the box on your front.
Right, the box on your front. And then ease one arm out of one shoulder strap. Turn over on your tummy, and the wind takes the parachute right off you. That's what you're told to do, and I've always found it works perfectly. A lot of people used to sort of pull the chute in against the wind and then run round it and all that sort of stuff. But there's no need to. That simple action, as told us, was absolutely perfect. And we got dragging drill by being put in a harness and having two blokes drag you across the grass while you got out of it.
Now, I did rather interrupt you. You were going on to the second week's training.
The second week, yes, it was a very tough week. On the Monday, we did two drops, one after the other, two aircraft drops, our first two.
Tell me about the procedure for an aircraft drill. I will ask you again when you're in action, but this is perhaps concentrate on the nitty-gritty of it.
Well, the second, your aircraft arrive, and it was one stick.
Would this be a Dakota?
This was not the Dakota. No, this was we were still using Whitley bombers with a hole in the floor. And I've just forgotten how many went at a time on this thing. Not an awful lot of men. Maximum a dozen of us. The instructors came aboard wearing ordinary RAF parachutes. We had static chutes. Our static chutes issued. We climbed aboard. We were told before we got on what position to take. We were told to hook up, and the instructor crawled the full length of the fuselage and checked that we were hooked up properly, because you have a strop. Your static line is hooked onto a strop. It's a short line of a strop. And in that strop, it's like a dog lead catch, a spring catch. But one of those springs once came open by hitting the side of the aircraft, and a chap lost his life. So we have a pin, a safety pin, a big, big safety pin goes through that hook, so it cannot come undone under any circumstances. So you hook up, and your instructor calls the length of the plane and makes certain that your hooking up is right. And then up you go, and then when you get near the dropping zone, he tells you again near the dropping zone, and number one to go through the hole gets sat on the edge of the hole and waits, and the red light comes on.
Did you check again? I mean, some people have said that there was a check whereby you check the bag, the kit of the person in front of you. Are you aware of anything about
this,
that?
This will have been later, but don't forget.
Okay, we'll come back to that.
My parachuting career was cut a bit short.
Okay, so, sorry, the red light comes on.
Yes, now, it was interesting. And then when the green light comes on, he yells, go, and out you go, and you go out as fast as each other, on top of each other. But halfway through, that chap has to sit on the edge of the hole and shout out, container, 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 because the man before him, his drop is attached to the container release, and the man before him has released the containers. So you've got to let those go through, and then just this drill of shouting, container, 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 and then the next man went through. And the first drop was uneventful that morning. The second drop, I came in backwards, and I did the most beautiful backwards somersault. And when we were debriefed, I was amazed to get ticked off for it. So was everybody else amazed I'd been ticked off. And apparently they didn't like you coming in backwards. I've come in backwards since, but that was later in my 70s. But they didn't like me coming in backwards, and it took
me. Why not?
Because you're supposed to have turned your chute so that but manipulating your lift, we're supposed to turn your chute so you're facing. But I thought that I was doing it all right. I could see the ground. I could turn round. I was going to do a nice backward roll. And the description of my drop from the ground observer was, finishing with a backward roll. And Spodlina Murphy said, not a very creditable performance. Anyway, it didn't bother me, it didn't deter me. But the next morning, we had another disaster. We've done two balloons, and we've done our third, by the time Tuesday came, we had done our third aircraft drop. That's a total of five so far, and I'm afraid we lost a man that morning. His chute didn't develop.
Can you tell me about that? Because that was quite a rare occurrence.
It was getting a rare occurrence, but we lost a bloke. His chute just did not develop properly. And it cast a bit of a gloom across the squad.
Did it affect people's nerve?
No, I don't think so. We had nobody back off. Nobody of our squad backed off at all. So we had two more on the Wednesday and the Thursday. We did a jump on each day, And the Friday was our final jump, which was in the form of a scheme. We were going to do an attack, an airborne attack. There was an objective in Tatton Hall that we were going to move on to in platoon order. And we had to carry weapons that morning. I carried a Sten across my chest. And we had the containers with weapons on board and all the rest of it. It was our first introduction to simulating operating. Now, this is where my parachuting finished for a long, long time. Unfortunately, I went out and I had what's called a thrown line. One of the lines was astray. It hooked under my hand between my fingers. And before I could say Jack Robinson, it had pulled my arm right the wrong way above my head, as you would do to a wrestler in a half Nelson. And I had no idea, but this my arm was absolutely useless, completely useless. And so I hooked it up into my webbing to do something with it. I pulled it with the other arm, hooked it in my webbing, and made my landing with just one arm. Well, you don't need your arms for landing. Made my landing. I got out of my parachute, picked myself up, and started joining the rest of the chaps towards the objective, and I kept on toppling over. And eventually, an Air Force medic picked me up and took me to a little hut where there was a squadron leader doctor, looked at me, and I said, well, hurry up, Doc. I said, I want to get on with the scheme. He said, no, Larry, he said, you, there's no scheme for you today. You've had this. And he put my arm in a sling and said, you get in the bus and go back to barracks. You're not doing any more today. The next day, they were all going home, but I didn't. I was sent off to hospital, to Davie Hume Hospital in Manchester, where I saw an army doctor who looked at it, and he said, oh, you're going to be all right. You're going to be able to go back and join your unit. You've got, wait a moment, he said. There's something serious here. I hadn't seen it at first. Sorry, but you're stopping here. You're not, you said, get your batman to fetch your kit. You're going to be admitted right away. You've got a very serious fracture here. So,
where was the fracture? Which
part? In the left shoulder blade. It turned out to be fractured in 17 pieces. So that night, I was on the operating table and put in a tight splint and my arm strapped to my body. There was no incision made, it was just a manipulation. And I was put back into bed and I just had to stay still. Well, the next day my wife and my mother came and visited me from London, and I was just in hospital for a long time. And then after all about 7 days, the surgical specialist, a very nice chap, I've just forgotten his name for the moment, said, we're not making any progress, we're going to operate again, we're going to open you up. So I had a real major operation and a long scar, which I've still got, right the full length of my shoulder blade. And they found all these pieces and they put them all together and sewed me up again. And I was about another 4 or 5 weeks in that hospital, having mainly physiotherapy. And I was put in one of these aeroplane splints, you know, with your arm in the middle of the air all the time up here like this. And then, as my brother-in-law was one of the leading orthopedic surgeons of the nation, chap called Ronnie Furlong. He'd come into the army. He'd been given the immediate rank of brigadier, and he was functioning down in Purford, Surrey, and he went behind the scenes and got me shifted to Boss's Hospital in Chertsey, where I went under intensive rehabilitation, physical training, as well as massage and all the rest of it. And I went flat out. I did all I could to get fit. I really worked hard to get absolutely fit. I wanted to get back to that battalion and get back to parachuting. Anyway, eventually I was to go before a medical board. The board came to the hospital And I stood there in the middle of this board, and they pulled my arm and twisted it and asked me to do this, that, and the other. And they said, oh, you'll be all right, you'll be fine, you've got nothing to worry about. And I was cocky as anything, felt delighted. And after 2 days, I got a notice, a note saying the board's decision is you are medical category C. Now, that was a terrible disappointment, but that meant my days in the parachute regiment were over. So, what I did, I noticed that on the slip from War Office, it was signed by a Major Tully Turner, whom I knew. I'd worked with him when I'd been adjutant of the 70th Middlesex. So I rang him up. I said, this is disgusting. I am not going to accept it. And you know better than to send me a note telling me I'm C. I demand you make me A. He said, I can't make you A. He said, more than my life's worth. He said, I'll tell you what I can do. I can get you wangled up to B to get you back to the battalion. So I said, right, will you do that? And the corrective slip came out to me, grading me B, so I was able to go back to the battalion. I was home for about a fortnight, and I went back to the battalion.
Now, when did you rejoin them?
I joined the battalion in the early days of January, 1944, early January.
So you'd been away about two and a half months.
Yeah. I joined them in early 44. CO was very pleased to see me back, and I went. He realized I wasn't able to parachute under the medical situation, but he put me in charge of a platoon straight away on an exercise the next day. I was to be motored out to the dropping zone to meet the people there, but the whole battalion got motored out because the weather was not fit for the battalion to drop.
Now, so you'd rejoined them at Kiwi Barracks at Bullard?
Yeah. So I was appointed. I had three appointments given to me. I was appointed battalion administrative officer. I was appointed OC home details, and I was appointed in charge of this platoon.
Well, tell me about these. What was your job as battalion administrative officer? Well, now, what did you have to do?
This is rather interesting because the administrative officer's job was created in the army establishment mainly to take the load off the quartermaster when you were emplaning a whole battalion of men. It didn't work out like that, and from the practical point of view, battalion COs were told to use their administrative officers in the best way they could to help the battalion. So Terence Otway was not commanding the battalion at the time. It was Martin Lindsay was in command. And I can tell you more about him later. But Martin Lindsay was in command. He welcomed me back. I was IC home details, substituting for a platoon officer who was away as an instructor at Hardwick, and at the same time, administrative officer. Now, what my role was, I was president of the officers' mess committee, one. I was president of the Regimental Institute, two. I was put in charge of what is called the CO's Fund, which is a separate welfare fund kept for the CO to give in cases of personal domestic hardship to soldiers in the battalion. I was put in charge of transport, ground transport.
Now, hang on, we need to look at these one by one, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
What about the first one?
Well, running the officer's mess, a straightforward job that's been going exist in the army since I suppose Cromwell's days.
What did you have to do?
I had to have been in charge of ordering all the food, ordering all the drink, doing all the accounts, sending out mess bills, making certain of the efficiency of the mess staff, making certain that the right people are on duty at the right time, moving food for the officers out on exercise or any other outside thing that was happening. And I was also responsible. That's the officer's mess job. That's the officer's mess job.
And then the other part?
Now, president of the Regimental Institute is looking after everything concerning the men's welfare from the standpoint of liaising with NAFI to make certain they did their stuff properly, and being responsible for organizing sport and being responsible for the organization of entertainment for the troops in the evening, such as dances and all that sort of thing. Then
The CO's fund, you talked about CO's fund in a bit more detail.
A small fund, which was a rather unusual thing, and I had to write to various notable people to ask them to give us the odd tenner and so forth, which they did, and mainly civilian people, and it was used in the case of a welfare problem which was not big enough, shall we say, to refer to the Airborne Forces Security Fund.
What sort of thing?
Well, I mean, if a chap came to the CO and said, look, that I when I came in, I had this terrible debt, my wife's been unable to pay it off, or my wife's had a most expensive medical bill to pay, that sort of thing.
And the responsibility for transport?
For transport, I was absolutely responsible for all the wheeled vehicles in the battalion.
Were you actually the MT officer then?
I was MT officer. I was responsible for all the motor transport. And
what did you have?
We had 3-ton trucks, and we had an enormous number of jeeps. And we had motorcycles. We had chuff chuffs, as we used to call them, a little folding motorcycle. And we had normal pickups. It was quite a mixture of stuff. And a lot of it went abroad with us, of course, in the end. Yes, I was responsible for all that lot. I was also responsible, as far as I remember, for the messing of the men, buying, supervising the supply of the food for the other ranks. Not the sergeant's mess, but for the other ranks.
What did that involve?
Involved checking the parade state against available food every day and making certain there's a proper variety of food, and the cookhouse staff were doing their stuff properly and the meals were satisfactory, all that sort of thing.
So busy down. Now, and your other job was as a sort of stand-in platoon commander. Tell me about...
Well, I was a stand-in platoon commander, and I went on parade every morning, and I would be platooning most of the morning and then doing administration most of the afternoon and into the evening. It was a very busy life. And then the most incredible thing happened.